The way JD hears stuff. Now, my husband has hearing aids. He's always had a hearing problem, even before his ears went. It's how he hears it. It's how he hears it and what it says to him. Like, for instance, I could come in and I could say, JD, there's something wrong with the car. Do you know what JD heard? JD, a good husband would go out there and fix his wife's car. Now, that's the last thing I want in the world is for JD to touch my car, because JD is a welder. He's not a car mechanic. He's not an electrician. He's not a plumber. He's none of those things. But what he does wonderful. But he's not one of those things. And just because I make a comment that the car needs says something wrong with it, he would think he needed to go out. So he would go out and start tinkering with my car, and then I'd have to get a wrecker to take it into the shop where I was going to take it in the first place. So we decided it was just easier. And when something went wrong with it, I kept it to myself and just had the darn thing fixed instead of trying to tell him. I was just giving him information, but he heard it as a good husband would do this. And that was the feelings of inadequacy on the side of him that made him feel that way. Now we have peace at any price. Well, peace at any price is just too darn expensive to your self-esteem. Giving in and keeping resentments instead of being honest. Keeping secrets or telling little lies. I once saw a sign on a company that puts little sayings on their sign, and it said, a half truth is a whole lie. I didn't like reading that. And I think that's why it stayed with me all these years, because I had a tendency to just tell part of the story. And that's just the half truth. But, you know, the thing about it is that keeping secrets and those things has caused us lots of problems in the past. And so we don't want to have that anymore. And every once in a while, one of us will forget and we'll just omit telling something. And then it'll come back and bite you. And you know, the thing of it is, I was a fit thrower. And JD had to trust me not to throw a fit so that he could tell me the truth. And it was real hard sometimes not to throw the fit when he told me the truth. But this is progress, not perfection. I'd like to say, we don't ever do that anymore, but that's not true. Sometimes we still have those things, but those are things we need to remember that do not add anything to our relationship. If anything, it takes stuff away from our relationship. Now, JD's a pack rat, and I'm Mrs. Organization, you know, and we had to reach a performance standard that was acceptable to both. His closet is his area, and he can screw it up however he wants to. For a long time, I would go in there, and I would sort his clothes, put them on the hanger right. In other words, the way I do it is right. And I do it where all the hangers are facing the same direction. In the case of a fire, you can come in and grab all of them at one time and get them off and take them out. But, you know. Anyway, his are one this way, one that way, whatever. And I would rearrange it every time I would go in there. And he told me, he said, I wish you'd leave my stuff alone. And so I realized that is his stuff. Why am I like things organized. Well, it's not your closet. Stay out of his closet. And you know, the thing of it is, over the years, he has noticed that it works better when it's a little more organization than what he had. But he is not allowed to bring his pack rat stuff into the common areas of the house. I will not want a bunch of welding on the kitchen table. You know, and my husband, bless his heart, he's also one of these that when he gets rid of something or gets through using something, that's where it is. And he's always coming to me and say, have you seen my, no, I haven't seen your, because I didn't use it. And so used to, I would help him look for it. And then I'd get aggravated. And so I found out I don't have to help him look for it. I didn't lose it. I don't have to find it. And that's what works here. he has been getting better about able to throw things away, you know, since my mother was such a, had all this stuff at her house, you know, my thing became, if in doubt, throw it out. And so Daddy's getting more like that. He's being able to part with something occasionally. And it's amazing, just amazing. I think he may be able to touch balance sometime there, going at it like that. Okay, number 10. A relationship should avoid heated controversy. No one wins in a heated controversy. You both lose, you both get hurt, and so does the relationship. Power-driven anger, resentment, closed-mindedness, revenge, violence, all can be part of a heated controversy. It's just the very stage. I remember when I got married the first time, the minister said, don't go to bed mad. Well, I don't guess I'd ever get to go to bed because I was angry all the time. I'd been angry since I was 12 years old, you know. I went with JD and my mother on a fishing trip. I didn't want to go, but they had kept on to me. Now, see, I used to love fishing with my daddy, but my daddy let me fish. My mother has rules. You know, she catches the first fish, the most fish, and the biggest fish, and she'll tell you where to fish and how to fish. And it's like, you know, I learned a lot when I was growing up. I could run a motor when I was, you know, like 10 years old. I could do a lot of stuff. I could fix my own line on my pole, and here's my mother going to tell me where to fish. Well, like I say, Mama and I don't have the best relationship this time, and so she kept saying, I would really love for you to go with me and JD. They went all the time because JD got along with my mother. He didn't argue with my mother. I could not be with my mother that we didn't argue. So it wasn't going to be a great scene. But I said, okay. Well, it's in the summertime here in Arkansas. We have lots of mosquitoes, lots of mosquitoes. And my mother was one of these that wants to get up at 4 in the morning to go fishing. You get up and you eat a big breakfast and then you go fishing. Well, I feel like a fish can eat at noon like anybody else. Now, damn it, you don't have to go out there in the middle of the night to catch a fish. But anyway, I'm going along with it, sort of. I'm not saying much, but I'm adding it up on the inside. And so anyway, we get down there to the lake and Mama says, Mary Pearl, why don't you run the motor? I don't want to run the motor. JD can run the motor. He runs the motor when it's just the two of you. I know, but he used to run the motor. I don't want to run the motor. She says, well, I want you to run the motor. And I said, well, I'm not running the motor. And so we got into this big fight about it. And so finally, I'm going to go back there and run the motor. She told JD he could run the motor. Well, we get going, and so we get over to my mother has her favorite fishing places, and there can't be anybody else on the lake at the same time because they might see us go to her favorite place. You just can't imagine. And so anyway, we got over there, and my mother said, I want you to fish over there, that third twig to the left. I don't want to fish the third twig to the left. That is a buck bush over there, and I haven't fished in a long time, and I don't think I'm going to be able to flip it in there without wrapping it around that bush, and then I'm going to have to pull it and ruin the fishing place to get my line back and lose my tackle and start over again. And she just kept on and on and on. And I said, okay. And so I flipped it, and sure enough, it went around the little bush, tied itself in the knot, and went through the whole process. And my mother was so angry, but now that gave me time, though, to sit there and take my time re-rigging my pole. And Mama says, okay, put the anchor out. Now, the anchor is a 5-pound can of lead, pretty heavy. And you put it in, here come the instructions, like I've never seen it before in my life. My mother says, now, when you lower it very gently, very easy. You don't want them to hit the bottom. You don't want the mud to come up. You don't want to disturb the fish. You don't want to do this or that. And I want to just take it and fling it out there. But I don't. I do it the proper way, and I lower it down, and I go back to redoing my pole. And so when I finally got it redone, I was decided to fish on the opposite side of the one where they were fishing. And Mama said, why aren't you over here with us? I said, because I don't get in trouble over here. Well, the day went downhill, needless to say, and Mama would say, raise the anchor. I'd say, okay, now don't, here came the instructions. Don't let it hit the boat. Don't let it do this. Don't let it get back in. We did that again about every 15 feet. We went through that until I had had it. I had just had it. And I said, okay, I'm ready to go home now. I'm ready to go home. Mama says, well, I'm not ready. And I said, well, I'm ready and I'm going to run the motor. Baby, get up here on the middle seat. I'm going to run the motor now. I want to go home. And so when he got up there on the middle seat, my mama, she's refusing to take her pole in. That's all right. She can drag it off for all I care. I get out there and I crank that motor and off we go. And so mama always sits on the front end of the boat and gives directions so you don't hit a log or anything. And so my mama starts waving off to the right, like go right. And so I went right. I hit the log and sheared the pin on the motor. And I said, why in the hell did you tell me to go that way? And she said, I wasn't. I was telling JD, I got a great big fish right over there the other day. But I couldn't hear her. See, that's the reason you go by hand signals. And so she didn't realize she was giving the wrong hand signal. And so that's when I screamed. And I dived out of the boat. And I swam to shore. And I began to walk home from the lake. And they had to paddle all the way back in to the boat landing. Because, of course, there wasn't any way to fix the motor right then. And I was about halfway home when they pulled up alongside of me and JD begged me into the car. And I just didn't want her to say a word to me. I did not want her to say a word to me. And so when we left there, I told him, I said, let me tell you, I am never going fishing with mother again in my life. And I didn't. I meant it. I have a thing about I'm through. And when I'm through, I'm through. And that's the way that anger was inside of me all the time about her. Well, JD also began to be a recipient of the anger as the time went on. And like I say, he wanted a sports car. I wanted the station wagon. We went to buy a new vehicle. We bought a truck. Nobody wanted that. That's how we made decisions. You know, I wouldn't give in on my car. He wouldn't give in on his sports car. So we got something neither one of us would be happy with. That way the other one didn't win. I don't understand why we did stuff like that. When I look at it now, I'm thinking, my God, we were so sick. But anyway, one morning, JD had, we at that point, though, we still had this truck and he had a sports car. You see, he got the sports car anyway. And it was a little MG Midget. Now, I don't know how many of y'all have ever ridden in an MG Midget, but if you're a woman of any size, you put it on and take it off. You do not get in and out. It's a very teeny tiny car. Once you get in, you have room for your legs, but getting in and out is absolutely impossible. And that's in the days where we had the bouffant hairdos that went way up to the top, you know, and I had this long, long hair and had it way up on top of my head. And he would tell me, come on, ride with me in the car. No, it's too hard. I said, it's just too hard. I have to fall into the car. I learned if you turn sideways and just fall in, then bring your legs around. But in trying to get out, I'd get my feet hung in the steering wheel. I don't know how that happened, but that was the way I got out of the car. And so I told him, I said, my girlfriend and I are going to go grocery shopping tomorrow, so please leave us the truck. Well, when I got up, the truck was gone and the sports car was there. He thought it'd be funny thinking about me and her because she weighed over 300 pounds and I was close to that. And thinking about us being in that car, he got a charge out of that. Ha, ha, ha. And so it was in the wintertime. We have on our winter coats, so that takes up more room in the little teeny car. So we get in the car. I get in the car and I'm going through the gears. And as I'm going over, when she sees me coming from a couple blocks away, the school ground there, she's standing on the front porch, shaking her head. No, no, didn't gonna work. And I told her, I said, come on. And she said, I can't. I said, yes, you can and you will. I said, come on, think positive. I said, he thinks he's gonna keep us from doing this, but he's not. And so she got there and I told her how to sit sideways and she sat down and the car rocked a little bit. And I went in and got in on the other side and we got started. And she said, wow. Because you see, every time I shifted gears, she got a spiritual experience. It was a really close contact in that thing. So we get up to the grocery store And lo and behold, I got out, crawled out like normal with my feet stuck in the steering wheel, got out, walked around, and she said, I can't get out. I said, what do you mean you can't get out? She said, I'm stuck. I said, what do you mean stuck? And she said, well, I vacuumed or something in this seat and I can't get out. And I said, oh, yes, you can and you will. And I put my foot up on the car or on the door facing one way and on the, my other foot on, and I'm jerking on her like this to get her out. When she came out in a hurry and she fell on top of me. Now we're rolling around out there in the parking lot. And there's a guy watching. He goes, Lord of mercy, call a fire department. And I thought, I'm going to have to kill me some guy before I get into the grocery store now. And so then we go in, and now I don't know where I thought we were going to put the groceries. But, you know, he's not going to stop me from doing what I want to do. So we get him back to the car, and we're having to throw him in the back. At the back, there's no back seat, but behind the seat, there's a little space. And the trunk is about the size of a glove compartment. Anyway, we have all these food rolling around in the car and everything around us. And we get back in the car, did the whole little routine, and we went about three blocks and the axle broke. Now, I pulled the car over to the edge of the road, I pushed over there. And so that night he came home and he said, where's the little darling? I said, she's in a ditch over on School Street. And he said, what's she doing there? And I told him, he said, oh my God. He said, it only had a 500-pound weight allowance. I said, who knew and who cared? You did exactly what I told you not to do. It's your fault. Wasn't my fault. No, I didn't make the decision to drive and take people in. No, that was his fault. That was his fault. And so we got over there. And so now we're in the pickup and it's in the cold and the choke is on the car. And he said to me, I'm going to hook up this piece of chain to the car. And whatever you do, don't floorboard it. Well, now, if you ever towed a car, of course you wouldn't floorboard it. I mean, that was so unnecessary. And I hate for people to tell me what to do and not to do. So he got in the car, and all I did was took my foot off the brake and the choke because it was going. It was cold. It sort of jerked out at a lurch, you know, and it sort of slung him sideways across the street and broke the chain. And so he came up to my window on my car of the truck, and he's going, and he said, I told you not to floorboard it. And he went through this thing, and he called me everything but a person. And I thought, you know, I wish he hadn't have done that. So now he gets the chain hooked back up. It's shorter now. And so here he is again. Don't floorboard it. Okay. And so I floorboarded it. Now, that's a whole different thing. I mean, he ricocheted off of this edge, off of that edge, and the back, and then broke the chain again. It almost turned it over that time. And he came up to the car, and his eyes were as big as saucers, and he said, what the hell? And I said, now that's what happens when you floorboard it. Do you see the difference? I'm going to give you a reference point here. That's what happens when you floorboard it. So he said, well, the chain is now about 3 foot long. And he said, don't stop fast. Whatever you do, I'll go in to the back of the truck. Has it occurred to y'all, I can't please him no matter what I do. So I just won't stop. I don't care if there's a stop sign. I don't care if there's a red light. I just go on through, took him home. When we got out to the front yard, he got out, he was just seething with anger, and he came up to me and he said, never again in the echoing corridors of time will I ask you to tow me. I said, okay. And I went in the house, I said, I bet you will. And when you do, I'm going to remember this day. See, there's the revenge. 3 years later, he's in his little car over to his mother's. He calls me and the fuel pump's gone out on his car. Would I come and tow him home? Oh, he's mine. He's mine. I said, yes, I'll be glad to. And I went over there ever so calmly and serene, and he hooked his little, and he still had that little short piece of chain. Well, now I'm not in the truck. I'm in my big 12-passenger station wagon with my 450 horsepower engine. And so I couldn't even see the front end of the car in my rearview mirror. I could just see the windshield. There was his face. It was enough. And I pulled him out of his mother's driveway, very calm and serene, right up to the highway. And I turned on the highway and went 80 miles an hour. Now, you could feel a little bit of drag where you could see the smoke from his tires where he was trying to stop the car. You know, he was trying to brake and slow us down. No, it's not happening. I went around three cars at one time, you know, towing a car. And, you know, I was getting even. Now, if you'd have been on the road that day, that would have probably scared you. But it was a crazy person getting even for something 3.5 years before. 3.5 years before, that was the kind of anger that I had. You know, even though JD and I had been together for many years, when he got sober, he'd been sober for quite a few years. And he said to me, he said, you know, I really don't like the way you fold my underwear. What? We've been together 9 years. You don't like the way I fold your 9 years? And I roll everything. I came from a military family. You roll everything. And so he said, I don't like it all rolled up. And I said, well, how do you want it? And he said, just fold it. And I said, okay, I can do that. Why did you not say something sooner? He said, I didn't want to have the conversation we're having. And I said, what do you mean? And I said, I was folding them for your convenience. And if it's not convenient, just tell me. I'd be glad to fold it a different way. I do mine my way. You can do yours your way. And he said, I just didn't want to cause a fight. But see, that's how he felt about everything. He was so sensitive. And then one night I was going out and I said, I'm going to get us some ice cream. What you want? He said, bring me back some butter pecan. I said, butter pecan? I said, you always eat vanilla. He said, it's because you buy vanilla. You like vanilla. I like butter pecan. I had no idea he liked butter pecan. He had never said so all that time. And I just thought that if I liked it, he ought to like it. But I found out there's no rights or wrongs. There's just differences. And don't take things so personally. Just because he didn't like vanilla was not the end of the world, you know? I was amazed at the things that he told me that he liked and didn't like that I had no idea because he had never, ever said anything about it. And as a child, I had grown up in controversy with my mother, for God's sake. There was lots of violence, verbal and physical violence in our home. It was just a way of life. I didn't know how to deal with my feelings of anger. And one day, it was right before Christmas, and the TV. Remember when we used to have TVs that had tubes and stuff in them before all these flat screens and things? And the TV quit. And so I called the TV repairman, and he pronounced it dead on arrival. And I told him, I said, oh, no, here's another problem right before Christmas. They have to spend money on something. And he said, this is a problem? And I said, maybe not for you. You can fix the damn things. I said, it's a problem for me if you tell me it can't be fixed. And he said, I would call this an incident. I wouldn't label it a problem because once you make it a problem, then it sounds worse than what it is. And I thought, are you in a 12-step program? He said, no. I said, oh, that really irritates me when you get something really good from somebody who's not in a 12-step program. You know, we're supposed to corner the market on good thoughts. But anyway, I told JD about that night when he came in. So I said, it's an incident. It's not a problem. And I got to think, how many times do we label things problem in our mind that really aren't problems? Now, I learned that my sister was a grudge holder. Now, not so much with me, but with our brother, Bobby. Now, when she was 16 years old, Bobby was 20. And she was walking downtown with some of her friends, and he was with some of his. And she had a crush on one of the guys that was walking with him. And Bobby said something to her that embarrassed her. And we were driving around. This is 1992. We are driving around the United States, just the two of us, having fun. And we were talking about all these things that I had never heard before. And so she said, and I'll never forgive him for it. And I said, you know, Dorothy, Bobby's been dead since 1950. You think it's worrying him very much? You know, this was 1992. She is still holding a grudge against my brother or something when she was 16 years old. I'm going, I can't believe that crap. I really can't. And I told her, I said, well, you know, Dorothy, in here we learned that grudges, they weigh too much to carry them that long. And, you know, it's real funny because later on when my sister would lose her memory, I asked her one day, I said, do you remember what you got mad at Bobby about when you were 16? She said, no, what was it? I said, I can't remember. And went on. So she did forget it. Ha, ha. Anyway, so many problems are the result of poor communication. What did you understand me to say, and how did you hear it, especially with him who is hard of hearing? Because a lot of times he'll think I've said one thing and it sounds similar to something else, you know, but it's not the same. So what did you say? Say it again. And how did you hear it? In other words, what tone of voice? Did you hear it as something that I was making a big deal about or what? And I've also found out, too, that when my husband comes in and he's had a bad day and everything I do is wrong, everything. You know, you open the wrong can of peas, you know, I mean, you know, just anything and everything that you do or say is wrong. It's about him. It's not about me. He has something bothering him. And usually after a period of time, he will mention whatever it is that's bothering about him. But I've learned not to take that to heart. And for a long time, I did. I didn't realize that it was just him having a bad day, and let him have one. Just because he has one doesn't mean you have to have one, you know. I've learned that prayer about the situation doesn't always change the situation, but prayer will change how I feel about the situation or what I think about it or my attitude about it. Prayer will change me about the situation if the situation doesn't change. Then you've got to practice a lot of forgiveness. Forgiveness is a big factor. You have to be willing to forgive. There's lots of opportunities for growth here. You know, I remember one time I called the girl who was helping me with my computer, that very first computer, and I had been going through it, and I found all these little things I didn't need on it. I didn't need this file about balloons, and I didn't need this file about butterflies, and I didn't need this file about, and after a while, I got a little message that said that my computer was shutting down. And so I called her and I told her, she said, what have you been doing? I said, well, I would start a cleaning house. You know, like I go through my file cabinet and I clean out stuff I don't need anymore. And she said, well, congratulations, you had just did a lobotomy on your program. She said, you're going to have to reload your program now. And I said, really? So you see, I learned more by making a mistake than I ever would had I not had that happen that day. You know, I learned what to do and what not to do by doing the wrong thing. So I had to forgive Mother in order for us to have a different kind of relationship. And it took a long period of time to forgive Mama because I had to want to, for one thing. And I just didn't want her to die with us having bad feelings. That's the main thing. I had tried to make amends to her. Oh, I made amends to Mama about the first month I was in the program. I went to a meeting on amends. And if you notice, the amends step is number 9. And when you have worked step none, I suggest you don't try to do 9. And I went off over to my mother's house and I said, you know, Mama, you always said you thought I hated you. You were right. And that doesn't bode well for making an amends, I can tell you. And I was telling my sponsor about it later and she says, well, now you're going to have to make an amends for the amends. And so I had tried over the years to make a living amends, to try to be better. And I've learned that whenever I wanted to tell her to shut up and go home, I learned that when I heard her voice on the phone, to put the phone down and go to the bathroom and say, God, it's her. Put a bubble of protection around me so nothing I say will hurt her and nothing she says will hurt me. Because we had a tendency to hurt one another. And over a period of time, I began to realize the first inventory I ever took was that of my grand sponsor. It was called Things I Hate About Ethel. And I realized why I didn't like Ethel after about, 3 or 4 months. And that's because Ethel and I were so alike. And I realized Mama and Ethel were an awful lot alike. And so I knew now that I was like my mama. That's the reason we couldn't get along. It's been real funny. On one of the Zoom meetings I go to, there's a lady in one of the groups that right off the bat, I looked at her and I listened to her and whatever, and I said, there's Ethel. She's back with us again. <You know? laughs> Debbie's laughing. She knows who I'm talking about. Anyway, I used this God bubble for protection with my mother. And then I'd come back to the phone and mom would say, are you having bladder problems? And I said, no, I just needed to go pee a while ago. And I figured I'd go to the bathroom. And so anyway, I just learned that I can use courtesy, and I had to forgive her in order to have a new relationship with her. And my sponsor said, ask God to let you see your mother through his eyes. She said, he looks different at her. He looks at her the same way he looks at you, through eyes of love, not eyes of judgment, not eyes of condemnation, not all that stuff. But God looks at you. You're all God's kids. God doesn't have grandkids. They're all his kids. And she said, when you look through God's eyes, you're looking through eyes of love, and you're going to see someone differently. So I prayed the prayer way over a year. And I said to my sponsor, how long do I have to pray this dumb prayer? And she said, until it works. Oh, well, okay, I kept praying. And then one fall, I went in the driveway. As I was pulling in, I saw her. She was out in the back field raking leaves. And I recognized something about my mama. She was short. Now, common sense tells me, you didn't know your mother was short? No, I didn't know my mother was short. She was, you know, when you're a little kid, she's great big. That's the authority figure when you're a little kid. And that's when it hit me. Every time you come over here, you come as a child. You come as a child wanting your mother's approval. Never getting it. You keep coming over here. And as I'm walking back toward my mother, it's like I saw inside of her heart. And it wasn't a heart that was overflowing with love. I kept looking for love. And I saw lots of hurts, but I didn't see love. And it's like a person can't give what they don't have. And that explained my mother. My mama couldn't give me what she didn't have. I walked over to her and asked her to put the leaf broom down, and I gave mother a hug. Now, we don't hug, we don't talk, we don't touch. And my mother was stiff as a poker. And she just looked at me and I said, I need to do that for me. And every time I'd go to see my mother after that, I would give her a hug. And over a period of time, mother would get up and walk for those hugs. She'd walk towards you. She didn't hug back, but she was there. And then there came the day when my mama said, why, when your daddy died, did you become such an ornery kid? And I said, I was getting even with you for not loving me. And she said, what do you mean I didn't love you? I gave you a roof over your head, clothes to wear, food to eat. It was more than I ever had. You see, her mother had left home. My mother had left home at the age of 13 after my grandfather had tried to rape her. Her mother drank, her father drank, her two brothers drank, her sister drank. My mother was the only one that didn't drink. And she lived on the streets in the early 1900s. Now, if you'd had to live like that, wouldn't that be one of the grandest things you could do, would be to provide food, shelter, clothing for a child, since she didn't have it? That to her would have been heaven. And you see, I took it for granted all those years. Because that's what parents are supposed to do. But my mother didn't know. My mother did for me what she thought. And I can tell you, if I hadn't had a roof over my head, clothes to wear, and food to eat, I would have been a completely worse than I was kind of person, I can tell you. So I looked at her and I said, Mama, could you forgive me? what could I do at this point in time to make it up to you? All the things I've done to hurt you, many of them on purpose, all these years. And my mother looked at me and she said, forgive me for not being the kind of mother you needed. And I looked at her and I said, Mama, I forgive you. And my mama got up and she walked across the room to me and she gave me the hug and the kiss on the cheek. And she said, baby, I love you. I've always loved you. And that hole inside of me closed up. I didn't have that anger where she was concerned anymore. I had to learn how to disagree agreeably. It's hard to do sometimes. But when you're working for the greatest good, for the good of the relationship, this really works. No place for martyrdom in your relationship. Just think about the word martyrdom. The martyr is dumb. It tells you that in the word itself. And then, you know, I realized, my sponsor told me, she said, your anger is so quick. And I realized it's because I'm full of anger and I blow off a little like a volcano. I have an eruption every once in a while, but I never really clean out down to the bottom. And so it's just that next thing happens, and it keeps building and building. And I said, that's the reason I'm in such wicked shape. Tradition 11, each partner best conveys his or her beliefs and philosophy by attraction rather than promotion. Anonymity is a valuable asset to the marriage or relationship. Accepting others as they are and trying to live and let live and be the best we can one day at a time is learning how to be doing the gold rule and the silver rule at the same time. Now we know the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. But just as important is the silver rule. Don't do for others what they need to do for themselves, because you cripple people when you do that. You cripple them. And I have to live my program instead of trying to preach it or teach it. Putting my program into action, not just talking the talk, but you got to walk the walk. And so one night I was sponsoring this girl and we were having bad weather here, and we were taking turns driving to a particular meeting over in Little Rock. We live in North Little Rock, separate town. And so she turned to me and she said, I know it's my turn to drive, but she says, you know, I don't have any insurance, she said, on my car because my husband's drinking, you know. And I said, I understand. And I said, but I prayed about it and we're going to be okay. Let's go. So we got in her car and off we went. Well, when we came out of the meeting, there was a coat of sleet all over the road. And when we got up on the freeway, there's a big overpass. And as we started up the overpass, we saw cars going every which way. And they were having a huge wreck in progress, just every which way. And so she panicked and slammed on the brake. And when she did, she began to swirl. Her car began to swirl. And I said, turn in the direction of your slide. Very calmly, turn in the direction. And she was so scared. It wasn't coming through. So I grabbed the wheel and I turned in the direction of the slide and we stopped with our front wheels up on, ready to go off the overpass. And so we just sat there for a minute or two. And I said, is everybody okay? Because her daughter was in the car. We're okay. So we backed down off of the the edge and we're just sitting there because, I mean, the cars are every which way, behind us and in front of us. And a policeman came over and he said, who'd you hit or who hit you? And I said, nobody. We're just waiting for the traffic to clear. And he said, I can't believe it. The next morning on the front page of the local paper was a picture of our car, of her car. It said, only car not hurt in a 27 car pileup. And so she looked at me and she said, I want your God. I said, what? She said, you told me you prayed about it and that God was going to take care of us. And she said, if that's not God taking care of us, I want your God. And I said, come on, we'll do it together. You know, people watch more what you do than just what you say. I noticed that my sister, we were driving along one day and somebody cut her off and she held up her index finger and went like that. And I said, what are you doing? And she said, well, isn't that what you do? Well, she'd see me flip birds. Little birdies. And I said to myself, well, you need to quit doing that, because that is absolutely showing other people how to be, and that's not how you need to be. So, you know, that was something she learned from me. And then I've learned to pray with the people I sponsor, just like I pray with JD. JD and I pray together all the time. We started praying. I remember the first time we were out in a restaurant and we held hands and prayed at the table before the meal. We did it at home, but all of a sudden, you know, we were out in public, you know, and I thought, am I going to be ashamed of God out in public when God takes so care, good care of me? No. And so that was just, that's us. Those things are just personal. These things you can work out for yourself. I don't try to promote the program or manage any other person's program anyway. I give instructions to people I sponsor, but you know, everybody works their own program in their own way. I know I was watching JD one time and I decided that he was not reading his 24-hour book like he should. I guess I didn't have anything to do that day. And I went over and I looked and the bookmark wasn't even in the same month we were in. And I thought, has it been that long since he's read that book? And so anyway, when he came home from work that night, I questioned him. And he just laughed. He said, I wondered how long it would take you. I said, what? He said, I read it every day. I just put the bookmark in a different place, because he said, I saw you. Look, watching me. You know, we play little games like that sometimes. I went into the evangelical stage of recovery. I think everybody does, where you want to give the program to everybody who needs it or doesn't need it. And so I first took it to my office where I worked, and I had everybody to come into the break room in the mornings, and I read to them out of the One Day at a Time book of Al-Anon. And we all discussed the reading for the day. Now, I'm the only one in the program, but everybody needs this program. And I hadn't bothered to mention that to my sponsor. And then I got a bunch of the 20 questions pamphlets from AA, and there were various people in the company that I knew had drinking problems. Our company attorney was one. You had to get an opinion before noon or you'd never got one that day. And then there was the vice president. I knew that he needed one because he would go drink his lunch. And so I put all these pamphlets on desks. Well, the vice president came around and he said, who put this on my desk? And I said, I did. And he said, do you think I'm an alcoholic? I said, well, they say we can't decide, but you can take that test and you can decide. And he gave me my pamphlet back. And so I was telling my sponsor about that and about the meetings at work. And she said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm evidently doing something wrong. And she said, it's for people who want it, not for people who need it. She said, none of those people have asked you to help them with their family problems, their relationship problems, or their attitudes, or their drinking problems. And it was about 3 or 4 years later, I was over at one of the AA groups at an open meeting, and there was the company attorney. I was never so glad to see somebody in all my life, because I really liked him. I really did, you know. That's the thing about alcoholics. If you notice, they're just so likable, except when they're drinking, except when they're drinking. And other people's alcoholics didn't bother me near as much as mine did. When other people's husbands would make an ass of themselves, it didn't bother me near so much as when mine did. I tried to get Dorothy and my mother to come to Al-Anon meetings. Dorothy came to one or two, and she said that was, and I'm thinking, you had the same grandmother, grandfather, uncles, aunts as I did. Your brother-in-law's an alcoholic. Your mother-in-law and father-in-law are alcoholics. Why do you not want to come to Al-Anon? And she said, it doesn't bother me what they do. She said, I'm living my life. I don't care what they do. And I thought, well, where did she get that? How did I miss that little part in life that Dorothy got? You know, where did that come from? And so she didn't, but she always said she loved what it did for me. But she said she didn't need it, so leave it alone. And I made a terrible mistake, and I took my mother to an open AA speaker meeting. when the man was sharing his story, and he was absolutely a hysterical speaker, and I knew that, and I thought, boy, Mama will get a laugh out of this. You know, maybe she won't be so uptight, because she kept saying to me, why do you want to go and be with those kind of people? And I would say, because I'm one of those kind of people, Mama. And so all she heard was what it used to be like and how he hurt his family and all these things. And all she could relate to was the pain of what she had experienced. And she never heard what happened and what it's like now. And she said she just couldn't. So I said, no, my sponsor told me, she said, leave it alone. You tried, leave it alone. So I learned that I can't fix anyone but myself, and I need God's help a lot, because, you know, I'm hard to fix. And people close to us, we have the lack of objectivity, you know. The thing about it is, I couldn't understand why my mother couldn't see why I was changing. And Dorothy said, well, you're real consistent for 5 or 6 times, and then you'll have a day when you go over there and you don't keep your mouth shut. So she doesn't see a change that lasts forever. She sees one that's occasional, see. I wasn't consistent enough. But every time I make a mistake, I have an opportunity to learn something. You learn what works by what doesn't work. And I learned that wisdom, I always wondered, you know, the wisdom to know the difference, the wisdom. I always had the knowledge, but I didn't know how to use the knowledge wisely. And that's what wisdom is, the ability to use the knowledge wisely. And I learned that forced change rarely works. You can't make people change. They may do it for a little while to get you off their back, but over the long haul, it doesn't work. Being able to do good and not having to be found out is anonymity at its best. If you get found out, it doesn't count. You know, you can go around and how can you do that? I said, well, I learned to have a positive attitude because that attracts people, you know, smile. I used to practice on the airplanes when I would fly a lot. And I would sit in my seat and start smiling, see how many people I could get to smile back at me walking down the aisle. Because, you know, on the airplane, it's not a happy place, especially nowadays. Allowing someone to screw up in traffic. You know, I make mistakes sometimes. My sister used to tickle me when she would almost go through a light or something. She'd go, I hate that. And I said, yeah, you will. When you get a ticket for it, you're really going to hate it. But anyway, I found that I had a tendency to be very aggressive in traffic instead of just live and let live, and realize there's some days that I know I shouldn't be behind the wheel. It's like, where are my reflexes? They're at home. I left them at home when I got in the car. I know, because I didn't stop quick enough, or I didn't do this or that. And I don't appreciate it when somebody blows the horn or flips me off or yells at me. And so try to be courteous in my driving, you know. I found out one summer a few years ago, it was so hot here, and in the heat, your temper gets worse in the heat. And people to drive and begin to annoy me again. And I'm going, that's one of the signs I'm getting spiritually off. And I said, God, help me find a way for this not to bother me. And then it occurred to me, I'm driving a 1992 Caprice Classic LTZ. It was the unmarked car of the police department years ago. And my car looks new. And so I had a girl I sponsor who's in the state police. She just retired, but she'd given me a state trooper's hat. And so I thought, yes. And I went home and I got an old hair dryer. I cut the cord off of it. Now I have a radar gun. And I would get in my car and pull up behind somebody wearing my hat and holding my radar gun. You'd be surprised how they slow down, how they move out of the way, how they do. It was hilarious. And I begin to be laughing in that traffic instead of having a bad attitude, you know. And so last summer, I was over at a favorite eating place, and this girl I sponsor, she came, and another state trooper over there came with her. And she was telling him about me and my hat. And I told him, oh, yeah. And I went out, and I had my car there and my hat and my gun. And we took pictures, and he said this was a hoot. He loved it. He took it over to state police headquarters. So I became the mascot over at the state police headquarters. And then one day he called me ahead of time. He said, bring your stuff out of your car. And I said, he said, or just bring your car. So why? He said, I'm bringing my official state trooper car over, and I've got the latest digital gun that they use now instead of a radar gun. And so I have my picture sitting in the official state trooper car holding what is the radar gun. And I'm telling you, that thing's heavy. It took both hands to hold that. And I got pictures of me. So now I got a big charge out of that. So did we. We just had more fun. That's what I'm saying. Have fun. Just have fun. Another thing I can do without getting found out sometimes is staying out of your business, just keeping my mouth shut. Or how about not complaining when everything isn't the way I want it to be? Just keep my mouth. And when somebody makes a mistake, you know what the kindest thing you can do? Keep your mouth shut. Instead of pointing it out to them, send someone a card or note anonymously. Pray for others. Do that all the time. Don't repeat gossip. Better yet, don't listen to it. That's harder. It's easier not to repeat it, but it's hard not to listen to it. Because you know, you always have that need to know. And to live with a light touch. We do a lot of that here. I came home from travel one night, and JD had been watching that Touched by an Angel program. He loved that program. And I was so tired. I came in that night, and I told him I was just going to sit in the living room a while and be quiet. And I was sitting in my chair, and all of a sudden I saw this glow. And I thought, what is that? And I turned around, and there's JD. He has a lantern on top of his head. And he's got his arms out, and he's balancing that lantern. He said, I'm an angel sent by God to tell you he loves you very much. And so do I. My name is Monica. And I tell you, I rolled. I could not help but just crack up. That was the funniest darn thing to me. I told him, I said, you've been watching entirely too much television, entirely too much. And I've learned to be honest with me, what's going on with me. And when I'm not doing well, I tell people I'm not doing well. You know, I don't, program pride is just not where it's at. Try to do good for good's sake. And I've noticed too, if people, there's a lot of people keep telling you how good the program, how this, how that, are they really working it? Sometimes we talk it when we're not doing it. Tradition 12. Selflessness is a spiritual foundation of our way of life as marriage partners or friends, ever reminding us to place principles above personality, and the principle is unselfishness. Our greatest gift is to be of service to another, and we can't do that and be selfish. There's no room for pride, selfishness, arrogance, managing, controlling, etc. in this new way of life. We learn to place principles above personalities in all of our relationships. And when you work these traditions in relationships, it's not just necessarily with a husband, a wife, a partner, whatever. It's with everybody. We have relationships with lots of people. And you have to practice the program principles. So you're really going to have to be able to have a working relationship with the 12 steps before you do this. Forgiveness. I went to the post office. I was mailing out flyers for a conference, and I was hearing from people that they hadn't received one. They hadn't received one, or they got part of one or whatever. And I'm going, part of one. So I go down to the post office, and they tell me at the post office that they had one of their pieces of machinery ate most of my flyers that I sent out. Now the flyers were in envelopes. And I said, wait a minute. If that happened, I'm going to have to send them all out again. Are you going to pay the postage? No. Well, I paid the postage. You chewed it up. I didn't get the result. And the guy said, well, there's your burden of proof. I said, what do you mean? He said, you'd have to prove you had the stamps and everything. I said, well, they're chewed up. How am I going to prove? He said, well, sorry about that. And that made me mad. And I thought, I think next time we go fishing, I'll get me a fish. And I'll put it in the night thing that goes right into the post office, and there'll be that burden of proof, won't there? And then I thought, you can't think like that. If you think on it long enough, you'll act upon it. So I had to work on forgiving the post office for being the post office, you know? And the thing of it is, because I had worked this program, it's so good, when my mother later on, she would, after we had several pretty good years together. And then Mama had hardening of the arteries to her brain, and she thought I was stealing from her, and Daddy was trying to kill her. And I thought, no, it would have been the other way around. Anyway, so the doctor, I talked to her doctor, and he said, it's easier for her to believe you're stealing than it is for her to believe she's losing her mind. And then after she had the stroke, my sister had the power of attorney, so she put her in the nursing home. And Mama got mad at Dorothy, slapped her across the room. Dorothy had never experienced that. She didn't like it. And so I told her, I said, this is what I put up with all the time when I was growing up. Then I had a mouth. See, I, even knowing I was going to get smacked, I would say something. And so anyway, I became the good kid. And when I go see Mama and I went to see her, I would go walking in the mornings at the mall. And after I would leave the mall, I would go to the nursing home and just spend some time with my Mama. And because I wanted to, I didn't want her. You'd see people there that they never get a visitor. And it is so sad. It's like people put them there and forget about them. It's terrible the way some people are treated. Anyway, I would go see her. And she would look at me and she would put her arms up like she was hugging me. And I would give her a hug. And then she would try to talk, and she couldn't talk. Her throat was paralyzed and she couldn't talk. But I would take her to get her hair done, and they put her in a wheelchair and tie her in. Thank God she was tied in. The first time I did that, I wasn't familiar with a wheelchair at all. And it was sort of on the incline, and she got away from me. And at the bottom of the incline was a dip, and if she hadn't been tied in, she'd have been thrown out of the wheelchair. And I got down there in front of her, and boy, her eyes were big. And she looked at me, and I said, I drive this about like I do a car, don't I, Mama? And she nodded, yes, yes. But anyway, I would take her to this beauty shop that was a couple of doors down from the nursing home. And she seemed agitated when she was under the dryer. And so I thought, maybe I should get her to do her nails, take her mind off of the dryer. And then I thought, oh, that might not be a good idea, because see, Mother always told me, never paint your nails. Because when you paint your nails, the next thing you'll be doing is smoking. The next thing you'll be doing is drinking. The next thing you'll be whoring around. So if you don't want to be a whore, don't do your nails. Okay, Mama. And I thought, well, she thinks she's going to be a whore now if I paint her nails, you know. But it fascinated her, watching them paint her nails. And when she got through, she would look at them. And then she would come back to the nursing home, and she would go like this to show everybody that her nails were done. It was a happy thing. And about the time I would get there every day after walking, The Price is Right was on, and we would watch that together, and she would laugh. And you know, today, even when I see The Price is Right, I think about times with Mama. It's sort of like, I want to visit Mama, I can go to Price is Right. That may sound crazy to some of y'all. But allowing people to help me, that was another thing that I learned. That was one of the hardest. In the year 1999, November the 30th, 45 years to the day I watched my daddy die, my sister died in the front seat of my car with me. And she choked twice, her eyes rolled back in her head, and she quit breathing. And I was in bumper-to-bumper traffic, and there was a new hospital that had just opened about 5 or 6 blocks away. And I was doing, I'm saying, God help me. What do I do? Do I do CPR? I'm driving. I'm right in the middle of traffic. What do I do? And about that time, I saw a motorcycle policeman coming. And I can begin to blow my horn. I said, I think my sister's had a heart attack. I think she's dead. And he said, here. And he made the traffic part. And he led me over to the hospital. And he ran in and got him with the gurney, and they came back out, and she was already turning blue. And they told me that probably she wouldn't live. But unbeknownst to us, I had taken her to the doctors that morning, and they had run some tests. They found out Dorothy was in kidney shutdown. And they had been calling the hospitals trying to find us, because they figured that she'd end up there. And because they'd tried our home phones and couldn't get either one of us. And I didn't have a cell phone in those days. And so anyway, they came back in and told me that the doctor had called the hospital and told them to be on the lookout for us. And so they knew what to do. And they said that her kidney shut down, it threw her heart in a bad rhythm, so it just stopped. It wasn't a heart attack, it just stopped. So they jump started her heart to get her going again. And but she was in a coma for 30 days. And the doctors told me they didn't know what we'd have when she woke up. That they knew that her short-term memory was going to be majorly affected, and they didn't know how much other damage there would be. And so I was there brushing her hair in the ICU that morning, and all of a sudden she said, "That felt so good." And I went, "Did she really say that? Did she say that?" I ran around in front of her, and I said, "You're awake." And she said, "Yeah, and that feels so good." I said, "You're awake." And I hollered for the nurses. I said, "She's awake." And they got the doctor up there, and Dorothy thought that, "Hey, I'm awake." So she got up the side of the bed. She stood up, and she did. She fell flat on her face, knocked her two caps off of her front teeth. And I thought, "Oh, my Lord." And anyway, then she had to go to rehab because she had to learn how to walk again, and she had to learn how to do a lot of things. And we found out that she had lost 40 years of her memory from current back, and that she had no short-term memory. In other words, you could go and be with her all day, go outside the door, come back in to her, you just arrived. She couldn't remember anything. She used to love to read, and all of a sudden, she can't read anymore because she can't retain from one page to the next. And there were so many things like that. And Dorothy, I would say to her, "How do you stand that?" And she said, "Because she did remember me and JD. Thank you, God." And she would say, "You have to accept it. What else can you do?" And I thought, "Well, thank you for sharing." My sister teaching me about acceptance, when that's something I've been trying to live by for years. Okay. But see, you have to have humility. You got to be teachable. And I can tell you, dealing with her and with Mama, it was like dealing with a practicing alcoholic sometimes. You know, you can't expect them to think or react the way that you think. And Dorothy, one day, without realizing it, she told me, she'd keep asking me, "Why doesn't Mama come to see me?" And I said, "Well, Dorothy, Mama died in 1991. This was 2000. And she said, "But there's no emotion." So I took her to the cemetery. And she was seeing Daddy's grave, because Daddy died in 1954. She knew she was there. She knew that. And she'd look at Mama's stone, and she would say, "Where was I when this happened?" I said, "You were right here." And she said, She said, well, you know, when you can't remember, it doesn't seem real. That's why she had no emotion to those things that I would tell her, because it doesn't seem real if you can't remember it. I've learned, too, in the program, not to discount the messenger, discount the message because of the messenger. You know, it doesn't matter who says it. If you can do it and be willing to do something different, you know, it doesn't matter who says it. It's good stuff. I used to go with a pad with me to the AA meetings, open AA meetings, and I'd write down all the things JD needed to do. Or if he was sitting next to me, I'd give him the elbow. And then I realized later, those were all things I needed to do. Whenever you're taking somebody else's inventory, when you get through, take their name off and put yours up, it's going to fit. Same thing. Because we hate what we see in ourselves when we see it in other people. And then sponsorship. Sponsorship has been one of the most glorious adventures. The willingness, enthusiasm of the people that you sponsor, and how it brings new life into your program, and watching the miracle of recovery in them. You know, Jennifer and I, she was a childhood friend, and I sponsored her for many, many years. And we had what we call runaway days, where the two of us would tell everybody in the family, "We're going away. We're not telling you where we're going or nothing. We're just going away." And we would go away and do something that we wanted to do. We might be traveling to another state, but whatever. We had fun. And then I have a girlfriend that had a swimming pool, and she was out in the country, and it was in the middle of the night, and she said, "You want to go skinny dipping?" I said, "I've never been skinny dipping." And so we're out there, and you see a plane going over, and I'm thinking, I'm out here naked in a pool. And it was exciting. I found out some information. Boobs float. Did you know your boobs will float? I had no idea. Had never done that before. So that was exciting. And I went to the spa one time with a girl in Texas, and that was an adventure within itself. And then I've had so many vacations with Sandy and Willie from California, our friends, that we would go and do things together. They would come here and we'd go from here and do stuff. Or in the next year, we'd go to California and do stuff with them. And we have some funny memories. One of my favorite memories, we were in their motorhome and we were in Yosemite. And while we were there in Yosemite, Willie had parked next to this little babbling brook. And we just thought, how fun, isn't it wonderful? And I had made this wonderful meal and we all put it on the picnic table there. We all sit down on the same side of the table and slingshotted all of our food into that little babbling brook. And I said, well, now here are two sober alcoholics and two supposedly half-assed Al-Anons. Look what we have done. But we had lots of laughs. We had lots of laughs. And that's one of the neatest things, that when we're together, we do have those laughs. And then there's another lady that her husband and I and JD, we were great friends and still are. And they invited us to come after my sister passed away. They invited us to come and to spend Christmas with them. And we've done that for several years. We weren't able to the last year because of my mobility problems. But Norm and Debbie and their family, we have had lots of fun at Christmas time. And that was so good because, you know, they had family here in Arkansas. And when it was real funny because, see, I met her in Florida, but they were originally from Arkansas. And then their family lived here, so they would regularly come back to visit their family. But also when their family would get sick or something, we were here to go and be with them. So we have a lot of history there, you know. And now all of her family from here have passed away. But they have family home, and so they keep coming back, and they come back here for our women's conference. Going to put in a plug for the Arkansas Woman to Woman. We didn't get to have it this year because of the virus, but we postponed it to next year. So think about that one. Okay, let's see. What have I got here? Oh, Tina and I were going. She's a girl I sponsor. We were going to Missouri and to a conference. And on the way, we had been at the meeting the night before, and this lady said that her mother had passed away in this little town we were going through. So we decided when we saw the little town, let's go over to the funeral home and sign the book. I bet that'll surprise her when she sees that. Well, when we got in there, there was more than one little woman in there. And we had never met her mother. We didn't know what her last name was, a maiden name. And so we go and we ask them, could we look at all three of them? And so we did. And we determined that this one looked more like her than the other. So we signed the book. Fortunately, it was the same book. But anyway, we couldn't help but laugh. We just couldn't help but laugh. We learned to look at our lives honestly, concentrating on the blessings instead of the negatives. You know, as they would say, having a new pair of glasses, so to speak. You know, sometimes I don't know what's good or bad, because what I think is bad turns out to be good, or what I think is good sometimes is not so good, you know. I take God with me. And keeping on close conscious contact, you know, apply the steps and the principles to my life. You know, I started with the group and then I tried it at work. And home was the last place I took it because that's where the most damage was done. That was the hardest place to get it, was at home. But you know, by the grace of a loving God, JD and I will be married 51 years this coming November. Not bad for a second marriage for both of us. And if it hadn't been for the program and our fellowship, we could never have done that. I've made a lot of progress. There's still room to grow. I've got to tell you about the cemetery. When my uncle died, he and his sister, my mother's sister, they lived next door to one another. You got to remember now, they were practicing alcoholics. And they did things to one another. They got revenge. One of them would do one thing, the next one do the next, you know. My aunt told my uncle she wanted to use his garage since he had lost his driver's license and she wanted to put her new car in it. And then he said, only if you take me to the doctor when I want to go. And so she said, okay. And then, of course, when he wanted to go, she didn't want to go. So he evicted her from the garage and she didn't get it out quick enough. And so he went out there and shot her car. Okay. So she gets revenge and she breaks into his home and steals a bunch of his papers. So he gets revenge and he burns the room off of her house. just a happy little alcoholic's neighborhood. And so my uncle died, and I always felt sorry for him. And so my aunt insisted that she and mother go out to the cemetery in a family car. There's only me and my sister and his two sisters, four people. They're going to use a family car. Oh, yes. So anyway, Dorothy and I went out there together, and we're waiting on the rest of them, and we're walking around. Well, my uncle, one of six that she had, that was the last one, and he's out there, and she had had this gigantic stone put on the grave, and it had his name, born, died, her name, born, blank. And so I thought, wow, I wonder how she's going to deal with that, I thought at the time. Well, I found out later she had it put in a little building off to the side because it did bother her looking at her own tombstone. So that day while Dorothy and I are walking around waiting on them to come in the family car, we noticed the stone is back. Look, the stone is back. And I said, do you have a felt tip pen, Dorothy? And she said, yeah. And she reached in her purse and gave it to me, and I filled in my aunt's date. I'm not well yet. I couldn't resist. It was just too good to pass up. And of course, she had a screaming fit when she saw it. It was wonderful. Not supposed to get joy out of others' misery, miracle. Slogans are great. Live and let live. But one of my favorite is, how important is it? Because everything was important if I wanted to do it. And I had to realize that everything that I think is not important. Pain seems to be the touchstone to growth for most of us, and it makes me willing to change. You know, when we can't let go, think about being on a ski rope. I used to water ski when I was young. And one of the first things they tell you when you fall, not if you fall, when you fall, let go of the rope, unless you want to do a corpse imitation and drink the lake. I mean, it's just that simple. And so that's the thing, you know, it's not painful if you let go. It's painful if you hold on. And so that's what helps me. I'm not going with the flow of life if I'm trying to hang on. And you know, the book talks about trudge the road of happy destiny. Now, trudge sound to me like walking in mud, where you go, you know, all that stuff when you try to pull your foot out of the mud. And I had an old dictionary and I looked it up. It was from the 30s. It said trudge, moving forward with a purpose. It wasn't what I thought it was at all. Moving forward with a purpose. And I said, okay, I can trudge the road of destiny, and I don't have to be alone anymore. You know, and JD and I, even though we've been in this house since the second week of March, we're not alone. People come and visit us on the front porch. I have a big glass door, and they sit on the bench on the front porch, and we sit on the inside, and we talk to people because the doctor says we're both extreme high risk, and she didn't want us to let people in or us go out, so that's what we do. You know, you don't have to like what you're doing. You just do it. You learn the discipline in this program, and I learned to simplify my life. Now, getting it simple is not simple, but once you get it simple, it's easier to deal. When you practice these spiritual principles, we become of maximum service to God and our fellow man. So we enjoy life as never before, you know, we enjoy. And especially now, you know, God goes ahead and plans in love. He put Zoom out here. He knew we were going to need something when the meeting shut down. And this is wonderful. You know, we've heard forever. It's a worldwide fellowship. We're looking at it. We're looking at it. It's a worldwide, there's people on here I'm looking at from different countries and one of you right in front of me. And, you know, we have a big book study meeting at my home group on Monday night at 6:30. And we had people from 8 countries and 17 states the other night. And it's like, wow, we're getting to see it. We're getting to hear all the different experience, strength, and hope from all over the world. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful. And like I say, we've gotten old. JD retired. He worked till he was 79. And then he retired. And now his job mainly is taking care of us because I can't do that much anymore. But he has been a real trooper to step up and do. And like, you know, he'll clean the house. Our house cleaner is taking care of her grandkids, so she can't come and be around us. But He takes care of the house and the laundry. And like I say, he's learning to cook. And he's been the best caregiver I think a person could ever want. And our relationship is special in ways I never dreamed possible. He has a lot of emotional strength and maturity. I know one night I collapsed in the kitchen floor. I would just felt too much to deal with my sister. And because I loved her so much and I was so powerless, and it's like my sister's body came back, but my sister didn't. And so he held me in his arms and he rocked me and told me it was going to be okay. And I said, how will it ever be okay? And he said, God will make it okay. I said, where is God? I can't see God. He said, well, I've got enough God for both of us for tonight. Just hang on. You know, I mean, that is a real loving husband. And like I said, you know, he said, come grow old with me. And so I asked him a few years ago, now what? You know, because we have certainly done that. He's 84, for God's sake, you know. But my life is so good. My life is so good. Just try and do God's will and realize things will be okay in the long run. I had a friend who was a priest, and he went over and worked with Mother Teresa in India for a while. And he said that when he was debating whether to leave the priesthood or not, and said he talked to her and he said, Mother, he said, would you pray for me that I should have clarity as to what to do? And she said, no, I will pray that you have faith. And I think that's the deal, you know, we have to have something to believe in, something. And, you know, years ago, I started a rainbow jar on my windowsill. And every time I saw God working in my life, I put a different colored marble in my rainbow jar. And then the morning sun comes through, it makes rainbows in the house. And I have filled many, many, many jars. So when you think God's not working, look at your rainbow jar. You know, it'll show you that God is working. And with that, I'm going to close. And thank you, Yvonne, for having me come and do the traditions.
Thank you, Mary Pearl.
What a blessing.
Thank you. Thank you.